Hi, I'm Keegan.
And I'm Madigan.
And you're listening to
Your Angry Neighborhood Feminist.
This is a podcast where we explore the world through our own personal feminist perspectives. And this week, we are talking about women in white supremacy.
So fun.
Yes. But you know what? Actually, I had a really interesting time researching this episode.
Agreed.
So I think we're going to have a lot of really interesting stuff to talk about, which
I'm
excited about.
And I think
about.
We have like a lot of different stuff to talk
about,
which is
exciting. So we'll try not to make this episode a million years long, especially since we are recording two episodes tonight.
Yeah.
So I wanted to kind of open up this conversation by saying that I think that we tend to think of white supremacy as being a mostly male-dominated arena.
Yeah.
Like, when we... Especially, I remember when Charlottesville happened, which was the Unite the Right rally, which was, like, a little bit over a year ago, we saw all those pictures that came out of, like, angry white men, you know, proud boys in, like, white polos and, like, high and tight haircuts.
Yeah.
And we kind of thought, I think, there was a lot
that
of...
That was it.
And there was a lot of talk about it being, like, a male rage issue, right? Like, they merged kind of, like, MRA mentality with white supremacy, and we forgot...
Which does go hand in hand a lot.
Of course.
Yeah.
Because the white supremacy movement is so rooted in the patriarchy and misogyny...
Right. Yeah, and they're both just hate groups.
Yeah, it totally is. But I think because of that, we totally, like, forgot and lost the fact that a lot of these guys, what were they, you know, at the very base level, women are complicit in that these men are going home to, like, well-cooked meals and a kiss, good night,
right,
you know?
Right, and that's what I was going to say, that these people, because they do tend to follow such typical marital roles, you know, the woman is kind of like, well, whatever the husband, whatever information the husband is giving a lot of times is maybe what their reality is. And if they're married to somebody who thinks that way, chances are, they maybe don't completely disagree, or maybe they even agree on a lot of things that they're saying.
Well, yes, I agree with that, but I also don't want to take away from the autonomous decisions that white women have made as
100%.
As like formed human beings. They're not, you know, not just like as byproducts of their husbands, but are deciding to side with white supremacy because it helps them maintain it's easier, you know?
Right. Well, and I think, too, when I think about when I was younger and people were like, why isn't there a white entertainment television?
Oh,
like,
my
people,
God.
Yeah, like, people want to maintain some sort of, like, they don't want to feel, they don't want the FOMO, they don't want the whatever, like, that they feel that other races, they don't want other races
to
be
lifted up enough. Yeah, they have oppression FOMO.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Like, they don't want to have other races be lifted up enough that they feel like they're being squashed, so they will start speaking about white rights and things like that.
And well, and it's very scary for people whenever they have been at the top for so long with so little competition,
yeah,
to have their way of life threatened in that way. It feels like oppression.
Which is so bonkers to me that it's like you've been competitive with other people and other men, I should say, especially when you talk about that kind of stuff, but just other people in general your whole life. So the fact that somebody with a different color of skin is like coming up, like, it's just a weird
I mean, I think
way
it
that
goes,
that should be so threatening.
It goes beyond competition. It's like, these are things that were supposed to be your God-given rights,
exactly.
Right? Like, they were supposed to be... It's different when you're in competition with other white men because you guys are supposed to be on an even playing field. Like, that's the way that society has been built up. So to now see that these people who you deem to be your inferiors are now your competition, that hits your ego in such a way. And it's scary because now you have to be better. Like, you can't just be kind of like an average white guy, like you have to be the smartest in the room. And if you don't get into
Yale...
Well,
and I feel like that's how people of color feel, too. They can't, like, they have
to
be the smartest in the room. They have to be the funniest,
you
know.
But now, like, the average white guy can say, I didn't get into Yale because affirmative action, and they're letting in all these black people who aren't as good
as
me.
Well, and it's the same thing with immigration. They're taking jobs. There's all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, which is all just lies.
So here's a... That's a good kind of summary about some of the things that we're going to be talking about this episode. So, as we've mentioned in our first wave episode, how there was not a whole lot of intersectionality when feminism first began, we also see different waves of what is called the WKKK, which is the Women's
Is it Ku Klux Klan?
Ku Klux Klan.
I always say Ku Klux Klan, and I know kind that's of not
hard.
Right.
It's kind of hard to say.
I mean, that's fine because I don't want to say it too much, so whatever. Leaders of the suffragist movement, like Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, continually sided with white supremacy in order to push their agenda of suffrage. They adamantly opposed the 15th Amendment, giving black men the right to vote, on the grounds that it would result in women being dominated by inferior men. And I have that in quotes. Hundreds of thousands of women were active members of the Ku Klux Klan. And decades later, white women led the fight against desegregation of schools and public facilities across America under the rallying cry of states' rights and limited government. So,
right. So there's a lot to unpack here and try to understand. So basically, if you go back and listen to our first wave feminism episodes, you'll hear us talk about the lack of intersectionality within the movement and the ways in which our founding feminists, our foremothers kind of pushed aside issues of race to further their agenda and push forward women's issues. And while they, like, some of them were abolitionists and friends with, you know, quote
but
unquote, they
kind
had
of
a black
changed.
Friend.
Yeah. But that kind of evolved and changed, and they started, as I think the feminist movement started growing, they started realizing that they had some traction and they were going to move further if they were to kind of relinquish some of those ideals and start pushing more toward
the
rights of white women.
I mean, and they used whichever avenue was possible to achieve that goal.
Yeah.
Right? But I wouldn't...
Like a means to an end.
Right. Yeah. It was a means to an end. And, like, I wouldn't consider them as members of, people who would have maybe joined the KKK. They probably wouldn't have.
No.
But definitely, they didn't help the cause in that way.
Right.
And then years later, so as we've already said, like, all of these white supremacy organizations are highly sexist and misogynistic. And even with women within their organizations, they'd be like, okay, I mean, that's great that you are here for the cause, but also we don't want you to be active members of our organization because we want you to be at home.
They wanted their own thing.
Right.
So even in this, you know, messed up group, the ladies were like, all right, we're going to create our own hate group, guys.
Right. Well, and how it happened actually is really fascinating. So at the turn of the century in the 1920s, women composed the most influential arm of the KKK. Mm-hmm. So basically, there was a founder of that era's clan. His name was William Joseph Simmons. And he was basically kind of like a figurehead, and there was a woman who was the mouthpiece of the KKK at this time. Like, they couldn't call her their leader for obvious sexist reasons, but her name was Elizabeth Tyler, and she was a public relations professional.
Yeah.
And they called her in.
Well, that's something that's interesting, because they call in the women from the WKKK because they have better, like, PR, basically. They would bring the women in to, like, clean up their image a
all
little bit.
All thanks to Elizabeth Tyler. Now, she's a disgusting racist, obviously, but she's also a marketing genius. Like, and so she was able to come in and kind of galvanize the KKK's base, you know, and get women involved and kind of do something that we see a lot happening now in the Trump era of kind of expanding the list of targeted enemies. It's not just black people now. Now it's Catholics and Jews and immigrants.
Yeah,
and
it was interesting how they would label it to make people almost not think that it was as bad, too.
Right. They would use, like, she would hand out, it was, they kind of hid it behind, like, social welfare.
The pamphlets.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is what I got. It said that the women of the WKKK fought for educational and social reforms like other progressive reformers, but with the extreme racism and intolerance. And they would basically, like, get people and, like, housewives together on the grounds of, like, creating a better, like, education system and, you know, keeping American values. That's something that goes for a long time.
It's the same thing that we do now.
It starts kind of, like, progressing into this weird, dangerous
Well, it was always dangerous because it's,
right, but they coded it, like they sugarcoated it in a way that would make these housewives think that it was a good idea.
It's the same way they sugarcoat it now, though. Yeah, it's the same way that they sugarcoat it now, like hiding it behind American values. Like they would hand out these pamphlets that would say things like, "Are you interested in the welfare of our nation as an enfranchised woman? Are you interested in better government?" And then they would organize these like picnics and lunches and cross burnings.
Yeah.
And they would rally around these, like, racist immigration laws.
Exactly.
And that's kind of how they segued into fighting for segregation.
Yeah.
And against integration and all of those things that we saw moving forward. One of the most interesting things that I have about the women of the WKKK, and also we'll go into, in a little bit, we'll talk about the United Daughters of the Confederacy. But one of the things that I found to be most interesting is when we think about Charlottesville, of course, we think about the violence. Of course, we think about all of the modern day Nazis. But they were all marching to keep this Confederate statue from being torn
down
because all these monuments were getting torn down.
Right.
Well, it's actually women who are responsible for most of those monuments going up.
Oh, yeah.
Like, yeah. Like the women of the KKK and the United Daughters of the Confederacy in particular, are the ones who, if you notice when they pull these statues down, old statues and monuments are hard to pull down. They're solid, like real. These were mass-produced monuments made of very cheap metal that women of the Confederacy, United Daughters of the Confederacy, and the women of the KKK erected in the 20th century, in like the 1920s, to further their the myth of the lost cause in the South.
Right.
And to further intimidate black people,
yeah,
like during
definitely.
The rise of the civil rights era.
Right. So one of the stated purposes of the Klan in the first wave was that females, friends, widows, and their households shall ever be special objects of our regard and protection, which only referred to white women. Many women were related to the Klansmen that joined the WKKK, and some women joined the WKKK against the wishes of their husbands, who felt that it was out of their wifely duty. So, like, it's weird because they were trying to be, like, rebels, yet it was just for such a horrible cause. And they believed that it was their duty to protect their country from the threats posed by minorities, which is African Americans and immigrants. They wanted to conform traditional status of women, but also wanted to assist in the white supremacist movement. We already talked about that. So from what I've read, about 500,000 women joined the WKKK during this period of, like, in the early 20s, which is crazy. They were anti-Jewish, anti-Catholic, anti-immigrant, and anti-black.
Yeah, basically, if you weren't an Anglo-Saxon Protestant, like, whitest of the white, from the South.
Well, this is what it says. To qualify for membership, one had to be native-born white Protestant woman. And you also had to be, like, you had to be sponsored by, like, two other women. And you had to, like, live in a certain area for a certain amount of time. Like, there were stipulations or whatever for people to be brought in.
Yeah. And I think it's important also to note that I think it's very almost Hollywood glamorous to think about the WKKK or the KKK in general, because you have this very, there is like this sliding scale of racism, right? And I have it here. It's the racism scale, which you can find at racismscale.weebly.com, which is a sliding scale that went viral after the Charlottesville attacks. And it's, we have this idea of, well, I'm not racist because I'm not a Nazi, or like, I'm not racist because I'm not wearing a white robe and a and a pointy cap, and
they, like, which they go to like the worst, like
right. I mean, but we have this like image of like that's what a racist white person is, and like, so while I think it's important to like share those images because it's jarring to see. I mean, I saw images of white women at cross burnings holding little babies.
I was just gonna say, with the babies who are also wearing the hoods,
and
it's
looking
so,
and looking really like sweetly at their babies, and it's such an odd dichotomy because we don't tend to think of women as violent beings.
Yeah. Did you ever watch? Sorry.
Oh no. Go ahead.
No, I was gonna say, did you ever watch Birth of a Nation?
The original Birth of a Nation. I have not watched it all the way through.
Okay, so I had to watch it in college for a couple classes.
Yeah.
It is the worst. It was so boring. And also, it's just, I couldn't watch it. It made me so mad because basically the
story. It's propaganda. Yeah.
It's 100% propaganda. It's about this woman who gets raped by a black man who's a white actor in blackface and then, like, comes home and, like, they, like, basically the whole town gathers around the family to, like, get rid of this guy. And then at the end, it's like a KKK march where they're burning crosses.
Right. It's like, a propaganda film. And it was shown in the White House.
Yeah.
It was shown in the White House.
Yeah. It's so scary. So, yeah. It's known as being, like, because it was... What was it? It was, like, one of the first films that did something. I mean, look how my film degree is working right now. But, like, it's one... It's, like, supposed to be really important for some reason, and that's why we had to watch it. But it made me so fucking mad.
Well, I think it's an important... Here's the issue that I'm having, and I'm actually glad that we're doing this episode today, because today, actually, in a girl group I'm in, I am getting so fucking fed up. I mean, I'm in a few girl groups on Facebook, and inevitably, once every month or so, there will be an eruption about race. And usually, it's a lot of white women getting really in their feelings.
That sounds exhausting, Keegan.
Oh,
why
no,
do you
it
do
is.
That?
It is. It's totally exhausting, and I need to stop replying, but it's hard to do. But it's usually, like, a lot of white women getting in their feelings, and inevitably, like, words come out their mouth that... Just today, like, someone said something about how, like, well, your ancestors. And I'm like, I need you to understand that my grandmother was alive during the Civil Rights Movement. Ruby
yeah.
Bridges, who was, you know, the first black little girl to go to
go
a
to
white school, is in her 60s.
Yeah.
It was not very long ago. And so for that reason, I think that Birth of a Nation is kind of important in that way to
show that it really wasn't that long ago.
And it was really bad. Like,
yeah.
This is a propaganda film.
What were we talking about where... Oh, we were talking last week during the Friends episode about the still showing those cartoons that were
right.
a little bit racist
yeah,
because
yeah.
it shows how far we've come and it shows that, like, this was real. Like, people
right.
actually
yeah.
showed these
I need,
cartoons.
Because of people like that in that group who think for some reason that black people are overreacting because
yeah.
it was something that happened a really long time ago, when in reality... This movie, a movie, which means
yeah.
it wasn't that long ago, was shown in the White House
yeah.
and praised as being,
yeah.
like, and it actually had...
And it's still being taught in film schools
and it had
to this day.
Devastating effects on the black community. If you
yeah.
watch the documentary 13th, they go into that in the ways in which black people have been criminalized.
Yeah.
And since, I guess, we're on this topic, I do want to go back to the United Daughters of the Confederacy, but it kind of, this topic kind of leads us directly into talking about... white women victimhood
yeah.
and the ways in which white women have often used their status as, like, pure beings,
yeah.
quote unquote, to criminalize and demonize black men in general, and to devastating effects. I mean, look at
yeah.
Emmett Till.
Yeah.
Emmett Till, in case you guys don't know, was a 14-year-old boy who a white woman accused of whistling at her.
Yeah.
And that's it, guys.
Yeah.
Whistling at her. A 14-year-old boy. Think about all the punk-ass little teenage kids you know right now, and imagine that. So that's bad enough already. She accused him of whistling at her, and her husband, and I believe her either his friend or his brother, went after Emmett Till, kidnapped him, beat him to death so badly that he was unrecognizable, and then later on, just recently, I think in the last couple of years, she admitted she made the whole thing up. Yeah, she
I didn't
did.
Know
yeah,
that.
There's a whole article about it. She admitted that she made the entire thing up because something happened. Her husband was, like, upset with her,
yeah,
and accusing her of something,
and
she.
So she did that to gain sympathy. He went
but
off.
But even
the
knowing
handle.
That, and here's the
that's
thing.
So fucked up.
Even knowing all of that. They were put on trial in the South, the two men who...
Yeah.
And there was no question about whether or not they beat a 14-year-old boy to death. They were let off, and she knew she lied about it.
The justice system is so fucked.
It is, but she knew she lied about it, and there's still a picture. It's the most disturbing picture to me. Like, you can see pictures of Emmett Till's beaten face.
Yeah.
Because his mom chose to have an open casket in a very brave move.
Yeah.
But the most disturbing picture from that trial for me is when the non-guilty or the acquittal came through and she is laughing and smiling in the courtroom.
What the fuck?
Having known that you lied and this boy was beaten and died brutally.
Yeah.
So there is this kind of idea. I feel like in the ways in which women can sometimes use their wiles to get what they want. I feel like white women have been able to use their status as, you know, you have been able to use white supremacy to manipulate.
Yeah, they are always and forever the victim.
Right. I mean, especially when it comes to black men, because black men are forever and always the criminal.
Yeah.
And it largely, and thanks to movies like Birth of a Nation.
Yeah. Oy, that movie.
Yeah.
That movie is upsetting.
Yeah. I've not seen it all, but I've seen clips of it, and
it's
bad enough.
I mean, it would make you really mad.
I know.
I wouldn't do it.
I know. Okay, so do you want to hear some things about the United Daughters of the Confederacy?
I really do.
Besides the fact that they did help erect these monuments that we are now trying to take down, I want people to also take a moment to recognize that whenever you see people being like, don't rewrite history. These were not put up right after the the Confederacy lost.
And why do we have to hold on to really awful history? Can I bring up something really interesting? Because
yes,
I don't know if I'm going to dive into this fully, but I'm a big World War II fanatic, I guess.
Talk about it.
And so I'm really interested in, like, the Holocaust in Nazi Germany. And so I started kind of researching a little bit about, like, the women in the Holocaust. But something that I want to bring up to that same effect is that where people are saying we don't want to rewrite history, there's a whole thing about German guilt.
Mm-hmm.
Where...
It's appropriate,
and they felt so bad for the things that they felt that the whole country was guilty of. Keegan told me about The Reader, and I thought that I'd seen it, and I hadn't.
Did you watch it?
And I watched it, and there's this whole thing, there's this monologue where this kid is like, it's all of us. All of us should be on trial because all of us are guilty of this in some way.
If you want to borrow the book, I have it.
I would love to.
Yeah, it's so good.
And that really blew me away because it made me think about how America treats its history and how they tell black people to get over it. They tell, they talk about the Confederate flag and how it's such a historical symbol and that we should hold on to it, where it's like, shouldn't we be ashamed that this is part of our history?
We should be.
And the thing is that the German guilt, they weren't, woe is me, feel bad for me because I feel guilty, where I feel like a lot of white people, because I've seen it, I've probably even said things in my own life, where it's been a woe is me, victimhood kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean,
you know what I mean?
Yes, and I do see that a lot.
Because you need to, like, justify it in some way. Like, I've heard it a lot.
You have to separate yourself from it because the weight of it is too much. Like,
but you want people to pat you on the back for feeling guilty. I've seen that a lot.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, where instead of focusing on the people that were actually hurt during that time, it's like you want the attention of other people for you being so brave to feel guilty, or, oh, I just can't believe, you know what I mean? And that's not at all what happened in Germany. These people, you know, if you were part of the Nazi regime or part of that at all, most of them were punished in some way. Most of them, not all of them.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the German people had to kind of cope with and understand and relearn these things that this horrible leader was teaching them.
Right. I mean, and along the same lines as what we were talking about with the monuments here in the United States, in Germany, they don't allow relics of Nazi Germany to stand. And it's kind of an interesting thing here in the United States because people, I think, distance themselves from the fact that, yes, while Confederates soldiers were and are Americans.
Yeah. Well, but they didn't want to be
They
Americans
were not
at the
fighting
time.
For America. They were fighting against
because
America.
Because they wanted to be their own thing so that they could have slaves.
Right. And so here's where we're going to go into where you were talking about why do we view, like, the Confederacy, or why do these people, like, mostly Southerners, view the Confederacy and the Confederate flag and all of this stuff with pride as, like, part of their heritage. I'll tell you why.
Please do.
And women are largely to blame.
Probably.
Once again.
And the other thing, too, is, like, women were the people that were, like, behind the scenes, like, sewing
costumes
and sewing flags and doing these things. So to them, maybe that symbol, I mean, sorry if I'm totally stomping on what you're saying.
No, go
but,
ahead.
Like, I can imagine that, like, if a woman's sewing that flag, like, there is some sort of, like, memory there that maybe that's why they're feeling butthurt about it.
Well, because, even, like, it's even more nefarious and, like, instrumental than that. Like, it was
nefarious
might be the wrong word. Deliberate. It was incredibly deliberate. So here's what happened here. So the United Daughters of the Confederacy were really the leaders of this lost cause myth that happens in the South that I personally experienced having lived in.
What's the lost cause myth?
Yes. Okay. So the lost cause myth is basically, it framed the South's involvement in the war as a heroic defense of the Southern way of life against overwhelming forces of the North, right? So it frames the Confederacy not
as... Is that still thought today?
Yes, and I'll get into why. Yes, absolutely. Like, that's why whenever people have these Confederate flags and they're saying, heritage, not hate, it's my heritage, it's because they were raised to believe that this was some kind of really heroic act on the part of the South.
But, I mean, I even knew that growing up, that it was a hateful thing.
Well, you did because... Hold on. So the key tenets of the lost cause myth were, one, that the Confederate fight was heroic. Two, enslaved people were happy and slavery was a benevolent institution.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot.
And three, that slavery was not the root cause of the war. You will talk to people from the South now. I have people that I went to school with in Southern Missouri who will tell you that slavery was not the cause of the war, which it absolutely was.
That sounds like Donald Trump fake news.
It's
like, only watch Fox, only do this. It's like they're learning in this little tiny bubble of
everything. You're exactly right.
Oh my God, thank you.
You are. You're exactly right. And here's why. And we can blame, again, we don't want to see women as the root of white supremacy, but we can blame women largely for this.
Yeah.
So not only did they erect a lot of those statues, but they also, after they've left the WKKK and that kind of disbanded, they went on to work in school boards as teachers.
Exactly.
And a fundamental focus for them was shaping the way young children thought about the war and Southern heritage. A pro-slavery woman named Mildred Rutherford wrote a pamphlet called A Measuring Rod for Textbooks. She had several Confederate generals on the board, and they dedicated to spreading the quote-unquote truth of Confederate history. Uh-huh. So they threw out all textbooks that did not, quote, accord full justice to the South, and encouraged all libraries to deface any books that didn't measure up by writing unjust to the South on the cover. So they would not allow them to sell. And here's an excerpt. Are you ready to be mad?
Wait, is that part of why Texas is so, like...
Oh, hell yeah.
Homegrown, like...
Of course.
Pride and everything. And I have a lot of friends from Texas who are very progressive and wonderful. My friend Lauren, who's a...
Right, we're not talking about all the people of the South.
Southern
I don't believe
pride.
That Texas was part of the Civil War.
I don't fucking know.
But it's the same principle, and a lot of our textbooks are Texas Instruments. Like, if you read them, or like...
They're Texas Instruments!
Yeah, exactly. They come from Texas. So, okay, so here...
Yeah, read me.
Are you ready?
I'm so ready to be mad. I took my shirt off. Boobies out.
You're
I'm ready to
prepared.
Be mad.
So... This is one of their approved textbooks one of the women at the UDC advocated for.
Okay.
The master often had a barbecue or picnic for his slaves.
Oh, God.
Then they had a great frolic. Even while working in the cotton field, they sang songs. The beat of the music and the richness of their voices made the work seem light. This is a History of Georgia textbook from 1954, and it was taught in high schools throughout Georgia for decades. Into the early 80s, they were using these textbooks. So it's not surprising that people believe
what they believe in,
of course. And continuing on, here we go. So they were instrumental in misleading the South. They formed groups called Children of the Confederacy, where they would have kids join these groups, and they would do things like have calls and responses. And here's an example of one of them. Did the South fight for slavery? The response is, no, for had Lincoln not sent armies to the South, that country would have done no fighting at all.
Let's think about why Lincoln wanted the fight.
But there were tons of these.
I know.
They had tons of these calls and responses.
And that's part of it where we talk about the chanting and things like that, mm-hmm. where it's like, did we talk about that or did I hear that on Keep It Weird? But they talk about the chanting and how, like, if you're chanting, you can't be thinking freely because you're going with the crowd. There's something psychologically right. that happens to you through that chanting.
And as children, they were given, they would, like, that's a short one, but they also had, like, very long passages that they would memorize. And they were given rewards, like candy and all kinds of things that they could memorize these. Of course, it was drilled into them. Yeah. And that, along with the Lost Cause myth that was being sold to them in all these textbooks.
And that's not long ago, you guys. Right. At all. Like, no. These are, like... Not even, I mean, my parents are old, but it's, like, not even, like, our generation's parents, even. It's
right.
Like,
well, this is the 1920s when this was happening,
well,
but...
Well, no, but you said that that the textbooks were there until the
80s. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my mom graduated high school in 1985. Mm-hmm. So, you've got this happening in the 20s, and then these children are growing up to be the people who are leading the segregation movements in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
Of course it happened. It's like these women who kind of like spearheaded this.
Yeah.
And you know what? It's disgusting, but it was genius.
Do you remember that teacher? We talked about her on, I think, a mini episode a while ago. There was like a teacher who was like promoting like...
She had a white supremacy podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, it's true. And that's the thing is like, they wanted women, they needed women to get involved because if men weren't going to do the jobs, like, be nurses and teachers and housewives, they needed all of their bases covered.
Well, you know? And if you can shape the minds of young children,
then
you can shape your history. Like, that's the thing. They rewrote history.
Our history is, like, written by white men. Like, even, sure even my textbooks were completely fucked
up. Of course. Yeah, but...
I even, like, it's interesting even, like, reading certain books about history today, how they just leave out so much problematic stuff and paint certain, like, founding fathers and things like that as being so angelic and perfect.
We had, I think, one paragraph about the Trail of Tears in our textbook. Like, one.
Yeah.
They're like, this happened and moving on.
Yeah.
And it was, like, a horrible, like, disastrous.
For me, it really depended on my teacher. I had a Black history teacher when I was in middle school, and he was incredibly passionate, and he showed us the movie Malcolm X with Jamie Foxx?
It's Denzel.
Denzel.
Mm-hmm.
But we watched Malcolm X. He was so passionate talking about Black history, and that it always kind of came back to that and whatever we talked about. And
exactly, good teachers
matter.
I went to
an incredibly Catholic school that I don't think would have had that kind of education had it not been for Mr. Webster. Like, he was really awesome, and I remember he pushed me really, like he would make us write outside of, like, the lines on notebooks. You had to write all the way from, like, binding to the end of the page.
Uh-huh.
And he would have us, like, write about really difficult topics. And I just remember that was my first time ever being interested in history. And even in high school, I totally lost interest.
Oh, I love history. It's one of my favorite things.
I love it now as an adult. I mean, these are my favorite episodes.
Yeah, me too.
I get to do research and things like that. But as a kid, like, I don't know. It just didn't interest me as much.
Resonate with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, like, to say that, that demonstrates what a good teacher does.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So imagine if you were brought up in kind of an echo chamber of just, like, the South was right, slaves were happy, the war wasn't about slaves.
Yeah.
And
the whole thing about them, they're singing songs. Like,
right. Ugh. No, absolutely. And that was in their textbook. That's
because they had to survive.
Well,
they didn't have, I mean, it's not like they were like singing songs and blah, blah, blah. Like, it's because they had to have some sort of, I mean, like, Black history, there's such a storytelling aspect because a lot of them weren't allowed to read or write.
Of course.
So storytelling and singing, like, and church and religion, like, those are things that are so rooted in their history and so important that they've passed on from person to person because they don't want them to forget where they've come from.
Right.
To twist that into it being, like, a happy, jolly, they were singing songs kind of thing.
I mean,
such a slap
in
the face.
Even now, I think Chelsea Handler, who, listen, she's problematic in her own way, but she did a thing where, I can't remember what that show was, but I remember I watched the racism episode that she did, and she went to the South and talked to people. I mean, and I'm telling you, even today, she was talking to older people, white people in the South, and they were telling her straight-faced, well, you know, a lot of the slaves liked being slaves and didn't want to not yeah. be slaves. Like, they truly believe this stuff.
And the only reason that that would ever be true is if you start looking at some sort of Stockholm syndrome.
Well,
because
I mean,
they weren't given any sort of, like, ability to create their own lives. They didn't like
right.
it, but
I think
they
there's
were
a difference.
Enslaved.
Exactly.
Like, hey,
I think
they were prisoners.
There's a difference between liking being a slave
yeah.
and being very afraid of what life holds for you because you have no other
or
experience.
Or going against the grain. I mean, if you're in the South, making it to the North, even then, you weren't guaranteed
well,
safety.
Yeah, I mean, I think they were talking about, like, when the Emancipation Proclamation came
right.
through and they were, quote-unquote, freed,
yeah.
which was also very complicated.
Yeah.
But then they were saying they didn't want to be free. They hated that. They wanted to stay slaves. And that is so...
It's so dehumanizing.
You're diluting the issues so much because, of course, I'm sure that there were people who were very afraid about, like, what the future held for them because... They were slaves, their parents were slaves, their grandparents were slaves.
And they could be personally afraid. You still
yeah.
had a slave owner that probably drove the fear of God into you.
Absolutely.
So he's like, I'm free? Am I free? No, you're not free. Like, you know, there would be that...
It's like a mind fuck.
Yeah, yeah, it's like they were treated like children that had to listen to whatever their, like, you know, father, master would say to them. Like,
right.
of course they were going to be horrified.
Right. I mean, and it's not to say, like, you know, they'll always use that, like, well, some slave owners were good slave owners and treated their slaves
nicely.
They were still property.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But kind of getting back to women in this
yes.
issue, I just think that that's interesting. We see white men as being kind of the spearheading force behind a lot of the more violent
yeah.
movements in white supremacy,
yeah.
like neo-Nazism and all of those, but we fail to see the ways in which women have been instrumental, like, behind
right.
the scenes.
Well, if I'm going to get real stereotypical, they always think of men being more physically violent. They're more in your face. You see when somebody's having an altercation because they're having a fight. Women, on the other hand, psychologically tend to be a little bit more underhanded, tend
yeah.
to be a little bit more manipulative.
Yeah.
They don't let it all show all the time. They're not necessarily going to punch each other in the face. It's going to be a slow burn.
Less often, yes.
Yeah, and it's going to be just a real slow, consistent
right.
Thing.
Which
and so I feel like that kind of relates to this a little bit because
yeah.
they weren't, you know, they were good with their PR. They knew they couldn't be outwardly violent and hateful. They had to kind of slowly integrate some of their ideas and have people start slowly seeing their
totally.
ways, you know,
which in so many ways I think is, I mean, not that I would ever downplay physical violence because of course there was so much of that and it was so
yeah.
scary during that time period, but the underhandedness is so insidious. I think
mm-hmm.
that that's what, I mean, I think even now
it's
to
so
this day.
Lasting.
Yeah, and now to this day, I think people kind of still make fun of, like, Southern women for that whole, like, oh, bless her heart. How you could do these,
yeah.
like, underhanded things with
yeah,
a smile on your face.
Bless her heart is really like, fuck that
fuck
bitch.
You.
Yeah,
yeah, like, a lot of, like, really passive aggressive kind of, like, kill him with a smile, with sweetness, even
yeah.
though you're saying something so, like, ugly.
Yeah.
It's still kind of a stereotype for women in the South in general, but like
yeah.
women, or in particular, but women in general. So, you know, that's just something to keep in mind. Before we touch on a little bit of today, I don't have very much, but, you know, a little bit, do you want to kind of touch on white supremacy in, you know, Nazism? Perhaps? Or Germany?
I'm wondering if we should just have a whole other episode for that, but
okay.
I'll touch on it briefly. Because I started getting really into it, but we do focus a lot of times on the male guards and soldiers in Nazi Germany, and we kind of forget that there were women that were
yeah.
part of it too. A lot of women joined because it was like there was jobs available. They were, you know, well paid, and they believed that that these people were prisoners, and that if you're a prisoner, there must be a reason that, like, you did something bad, so on and so forth. Not excusing what they've done.
Right, of course. Yeah, we should just disclaim all of this.
Yeah.
Like, none of this is an excuse.
Yeah. So they didn't necessarily, like, exclude women from being Nazi Party members, but it wasn't, like, they weren't openly invited. they kind of had to conform to typical gender roles, even kind of within the whole regime and everything. But many women played an influential role at the heart of the Nazi system and filled official posts at the heart of concentration camps. A few were engaged in the German resistance and paid with their lives, such as Liberitz, I'm going to say all of these names wrong, I'm very sorry, Schulz-Boysen and Sophie Scholl, who we've talked about.
Yeah.
So, most of the women who were part of the SS were in charge of, like, the telephones, the radio operators, and the stenographs, and sometimes they were at the camps. And the women in the camps were within the ranks of Nazis, but they were not, they were never to be in the higher sort of ranks, and they were called the, I'm going to say this wrong, Aufseherin?
I don't know.
I'm sorry, guys. But even, even then, they were most of the time secretaries or nurses. They came from mostly lower class and middle class social origins. Of the 55,000 numbers of guards in Nazi camps, 3,600 were women.
Sorry, how many is the total?
55,000.
Okay. So still a small percentage.
I mean, yeah, in comparison, it wasn't as much. But, like, I don't think that people even think it would have been that much, you know? So let me I want to talk briefly about a few women in particular who were fucking awful. So there's this woman.
Got the bitch of Buchenwald in there.
Yeah, well, that's what the reader is based on. And I don't even have that one, to be honest. The two that I focused on were Hermine Bronsteiner and Herta Ellert.
I don't think I know either of those.
I found some college journal or some college essay that somebody wrote where they compared the two because Hermine Bronsteiner was known as the Stomping Mare. She was, like, really, really tough. And then there was Herta Ellert, who was fucking awful, but also took a more subdued approach with their prisoners. Hermine became known as the Stomping Mare because she killed women by stomping on them with her steel-studded jackboots.
Jesus Christ!
She began the she became the head overseer of Lagerführung at the Jensen camp from January 1944 till May 1945. She was said to have whipped women to death, thrown children by their hair onto trucks before being taken to their deaths in gas chambers, hanged young female prisoners, and stomped an old woman to death with her jackboots. She partook in the selection of who would be sent to the gas chambers, and she was infamous for her wild rages and tantrums. She was sentenced to life imprisonment from the district court of, I'm going to say this wrong, Dusseldorf?
Dusseldorf, yeah.
Dusseldorf, on April 30th, 1981, but released on health grounds in 1996.
Oh, fuck off.
Before her death 3 years later.
Jesus Christ.
I know. There was a lot of Nazis who had very short sentences. A couple years here and there. Like, it was wrong. So, Herta Ellert arrived at Ravensbrück in December of 1939 and stayed for 4 years. When describing her job, she said, "I had to see the civilian workers did not mix with the prisoners, and later on I was detailed to working parties outside the camp."
Do you think, did these women ever come out and say that their primary reasoning for doing what they did was like, what was their primary reasoning?
Yeah, I mean,
was it white supremacy or was it more just like they, it was their job?
There was probably some women that did, but I think that a lot of times when we get these quotes, it's probably from when they were on trial and they had to make it seem at, like they were following orders. That's right. What I would assume. I don't know. I don't know that much, I want to learn more because it's really interesting to me. But yeah, most of them kind of just discuss it as being something that was just part of their job. So in 43, she was transferred to the concentration camp and extermination camp of Majdanek, which is one that I haven't heard a whole lot about, but in pretty much every woman that I was like looking into, that camp is mentioned in some way. So I think it was one of the larger ones. She claims that she was transferred for being too nice to prisoners, helping to feed them and not giving harsh enough punishments. They were among the first female guards and went on to hold senior positions at Majdanek, both Ellert and Bronsteiner. In 1944, she was transferred to Krakow, but when
Krakow, it's
K-R-A-K-U.
Oh, never mind.
But when they noticed how lenient she was, they sent her back. a fellow guard described her, this is the thing, is that there's a fellow guard that describes her, and it's completely different than everything else. It says, she was immensely obese, sly, vicious in character, and an absolute master in using the whip, and describes her on kitchen duties, spying on Jewish women while they helped prepare meals, while they were, like, peeling potatoes, doing things like that, and she would watch them, and then she would sometimes make them strip down naked while they were doing it. So she was kind of, like, from what I understand, she had the appearance of caring for them and being somewhat nicer to them, as opposed to the stomping mare, who was, like, very outwardly vicious and cruel physically, where she was a little bit more emotionally scarring. It wasn't as obvious that she was, like, being so damaging. I don't know. But she was moved to Auschwitz, then Bergen-Belsen, where she became deputy wardess. So she must have, you know, done some pretty shitty stuff.
Yeah.
She was sentenced to 15 years in prison, but was given early release on May 7th, 1953.
Jesus Christ.
1953. And we're talking in 44 was one of her transfers. That's my last date before that. But that's not even 10 years later. And she's already out. After the war, she lived under the assumed name Herta Newman. She died on April 1997 at age 92. So, again, that's kind of showing the different ways of violence, where one was more physical and obviously violent, where the other was maybe a little bit more sly and manipulative.
Right. I mean, and I do think it kind of illustrates, I think that the parallels between Nazi Germany and the Old South in the United States. And look, I do want to also say, I'm not sitting here trying to say that the South of the United States is the only place where the United States has a racism issue.
No, not at all. Because
it's everywhere, and I'm not saying that women of the South are all racist,
or
people of the South are all racist. It's just what came up a lot in my research, which is why we've said it so much. But what I find interesting in the parallels there is that whether or not you are, and this is kind of the thing that's going to come up and lead us into modern day a little bit, is that whether or not you are racist because you really hate that group of people, or whether or not you are quote unquote just following orders.
Or circumstantial.
Yeah. At the end of the day, you are trying to maintain the status quo because it benefits you.
Exactly.
It benefits you to do that. And we see that in modern day in 53% of white women voted for Trump.
I was just going to say, we see it in modern day where we talk about the upholding of American standards, American values. That is
quote unquote American values.
That is what Donald Trump based his entire,
which is so stupid,
campaign on, because so laughable. Make America great again. That is what he based it on.
Make America white again.
Yeah, exactly. And it's about conflict and abuse and horror. Like, there isn't anything positive behind them. That. No, and because the way his agenda that he proposed to them was not outward, well, it was outwardly hateful, but he would try to speak to the specific people that he was trying to reach and make it sound really good for them.
Right. It sounds good for you because that's what white privilege is. You know what I mean? It's just like, make America great again. Let's take us back to a point when the white man was on top. Yeah. And I feel like
white, and where men were on top. And yes. All of the things.
You know, but like, I feel like white women, why there was, and I hear it already. I hear it already because I've gotten it since the election of hashtag not all white women. You know, I get that. But here's the thing. Over half of the white women in this country voted for Donald Trump.
Yep.
And they did it because maintaining the status quo is easier for you. And it benefits you.
You guys, I'm going to give you one really valuable piece of advice that I have learned in my short 26 years on this earth. Do the harder thing.
Yeah.
Always do the harder thing.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't, and I don't mean do the harder thing, you know, like to do bad things. I mean, do the harder thing in when you see somebody struggling, help them, when you have to change your mindset, but you don't want to because you don't want to look at that part of yourself, whether it be personally or politically or anything like that, force yourself to look at those ugly, horrible things, because in the end, that's going to make you a better person.
Right. And I think also "do the harder thing" is a good slogan for the other white women who didn't vote for Trump. Because mm-hmm. here's the thing, you cannot all white women at me all day, but the point is, and I'm including myself in this when I say this to an extent because I am half white and I have white family members,
yeah,
many of whom voted for Trump.
Yeah.
And I can say, do the harder thing in continuing to be outspoken about your beliefs and questioning your fellow family members, because I think the instinct is, for myself included, don't rock the boat.
Yep.
Don't start
fights. You
don't
want to mention it with family because right. you feel like it's going to cause a rift and right. things like that.
But
yeah.
at the end of the day, whether or not your family members who voted for Trump are racist or not, they are upholding
a racist
ideology.
Yeah.
And I know that they don't mean... Look, man, I'm telling you, like, I have so many people in my family who voted for Trump
yeah,
that...
Yeah, I agree.
They're not bad people for the most part, at least the ones that I know, and they're not racist people for the most part, but you have to be held accountable for whenever
for
you...
For what you were voting for.
Right, and for yeah. when you are kind of allowing this, you know, racist agenda to continue, and that's
yeah.
that's kind of what's going on right now.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where we are right now.
Yeah.
And
I feel like, you know, they say the history repeats itself.
Yeah.
And I feel that we are at a time where instead of being progressive and moving forward and... wanting us to really be a whole country and come together, we are getting back to a place where we are so divided racially and socially, politically, that it's not doing us any good. And this whole Make America Great Again thing, it's making America worse.
Absolutely. Well,
because
I mean,
we are strongest when we are working
together.
We
have now had two Unite the Right rallies, one of which last year in Charlottesville resulted in murder.
Yeah.
You know, and bodily harm to people
yeah.
from the right, from the alt-right, quote-unquote alt-right,
and the
Nazis.
I was going to say, the alt-right, it's their way of disguising what they really are.
Right, and I think it's, I always say alt-right because everyone knows exactly what you mean when you say
yeah.
that, but there is also this kind of movement to stop calling them that and start
yeah.
calling them Nazis because that's what
they
are.
That's what they are. It's so weird to me that, like, you know, we talked about Germany and how they've just completely, like, don't want to be associated with those things anymore. But yet, I've seen so many people, like, drawing swastikas
oh,
and
yeah.
swastika tattoos
yeah.
in America.
Or you have the Unite the Right rally where you've got Nazi flags flying alongside Confederate flags.
Like, that's crazy to
yeah.
me. Because, like, the country that, like, started this whole thing... is so, like, we just want to, like, we are so sorry, and we will do everything we can for the rest of our lives. Our kids and their kids and their kids will not forget what happened, and
right.
we will try to make it right,
yeah.
and we will try to make it better. Yet we're over here still
yeah.
celebrating
yeah.
it.
Yeah, yes, and it's really confusing and conflicting. And, you know, I just, if you take anything with you, like, when you go, just keep this in mind when you see the Tommy Laurens of
yeah.
the world, you know, when you see the Laura Ingrams of the world.
The Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
Yeah, who are being complicit and who history will remember on the wrong side of history, praying that they don't rewrite our history books.
Right.
Notwithstanding, that you pray... You know, that just keep that in mind whenever you see these people and understand that they are perpetuating white supremacy.
Yeah.
And they are working to hold it up. You know, it doesn't matter that they might look, like, sweet or it doesn't, you know, none of that matters.
Yeah, I remember watching this video where this guy was, like, conflicted because... Tommy Lauren, is that her name?
Yeah.
Whatever her name is. Like, she's like... Yeah, you're hot, but you're a fucking asshole. Like, there's this whole video where I was like, oh,
she
can't even call
yeah,
her hot.
And,
was like,
to me, she's
Ugh.
So ugly because she's so hateful.
See it. You can just
yeah.
see it. Ugh.
I see it seeping through, like, every pore in her body.
Yeah,
so just keep
like
that in mind.
It's like green goo of hate.
Yeah, don't forget that while, you know, we've had episodes on incels, we've had episodes on MRAs, we are completely aware of the toxic masculinity that, like, you know, is so prevalent in our society.
But that doesn't mean that women are not somewhat to blame or somewhat
at bare minimum complicit.
And complicit to a lot of these things. Yeah. So, and that's, and I think that's what makes us good feminists. Because we are not just protecting every woman
for the
fact that they are women.
Yeah.
We are not, you know, we're not afraid to shy away from, you know, first wave feminism and their issues with intersectionality. And I think that that's something that's important for all of our listeners, too, to remember that being a feminist does not mean that you are to automatically agree with your fellow woman. It's to respect your fellow woman and your fellow man, but also to not turn a blind eye to the bad things that are happening.
Right. Equality means also, like, you are held accountable for your beliefs and your mistakes and the ways in which your ideology might be oppressing other people. And I do want to encourage, you know, the white women in my life, having gone through these things and these girl groups that I've been involved in, to really examine your own behavior as well. You know, take a look at that racism scale and see where you fall on it, because it's not always like wearing a robe and a pointy hat. Like, there are much more subtle ways in which you're contributing to the furthering of white supremacy. Yeah. So just examine that.
Can I say one more thing, too? Because
absolutely.
We've been mentioning privilege, and I think this is important to say. I am a white woman with white privilege, and I don't feel... like I'm putting myself down. I don't feel like I'm saying that I haven't gone through stuff.
Right.
But acknowledge your privilege. Acknowledge the privilege of your ancestors and where you've come from, and be empathetic to others. Take that to know that, like, you, it just means that you have to be that much more open-minded, and you have to educate yourself on other cultures.
Right. And also
that's what it means.
Also understand that, like, because I feel like this is something that comes up a lot, and, you know, I know that we'll probably end up doing an episode on privilege on its own, but maybe. I don't know. But
we need to start keeping, like, a notebook in here when we're like, we're going to do an episode on this.
I know. I think that is on our list to do. But also take note that, because this is what I always hear. I don't have white privilege. My life has been really hard, or I was really poor.
Exactly.
That's not what that means.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that your life hasn't been difficult.
Yeah.
It just means that your race or the color of your skin has not
been part of that
difficulty. Has not made it more difficult.
Yeah.
Is not a contributing factor in one of the things that made it harder.
Yeah.
So that's
and
just something
okay
to keep in mind.
And it's okay to admit. Like,
right.
I feel like it's something that people get really, again, ashamed
about. Don't be defensive. You don't have to be defensive
victimized.
About it.
You don't, it's just, you can accept that about yourself and use it as a wake-up call to have growth and understanding for other people. It doesn't have to be something that you feel defensive about.
Agreed.
You know?
Agreed. So that's a really good place to end it. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode.
I hope we stayed on topic enough.
We did, I think.
Okay.
I think we did. And this was a good one, I feel like, that we did. I enjoyed this conversation.
Me
so
too.
We hope you guys
like there's
did.
So much more that we could
absolutely
talk about with this.
You know, absolutely there is.
I'm excited. You know, we were talking about all of our episodes and kind of like themes that we have coming up. You know, when we first started, we kind of went right into Black History Month and Women's History Month, and we had all these very specific episodes. And I hope that we continue that every year that we have this podcast. And I'm excited for next Black History Month to maybe touch more on slavery and really getting into like the deep, you know, not just American history, but world history of a lot of these racial issues.
You know what I'd like to do next year for, and this is probably going to piss people off, whatever, it's our podcast. I'd like to do next year for like St. Patrick's Day, maybe talking about the difference between, because every year, someone will tell you that Irish people were slaves and that they have the right to be just as mad as Black people.
No.
And that's not the case.
Guys, my name is Madigan Haggerty.
It's
that
the
is
most
the most Irish
name
that
to
you
exist.
Could ever think of. Like, my family, like, we are Irish.
Right.
We are Irish.
Deeply Irish.
I've never heard that before in my life.
Well, I mean, and here's the thing. It's not that the Irish...
No one ever said any of that to me. And so
we're getting
why,
off topic, but...
No, I know, but it's like...
No, I'm with you, but yes, it's not... And again, speaking of privilege, it's not like the Irish had it easy when they came here.
No.
Of course.
But you didn't have... It wasn't racial profiling.
It's not the same.
Like, it's... Yes, we were treated shitty. It's good to recognize that. It's good to recognize where you've come from, where you've been, all that kind of stuff, whatever. Not the fucking same. End of conversation. We'll see you again in March.
Yeah, so if you guys have other topics that you think that we should cover, that you think would be interesting, or if you have more to add to this conversation about women and white supremacy.
Yeah, you feel like we left anything out? Because I feel like this whole episode has been a blur to me. I don't even know what we talked about.
I mean, I think we covered some good stuff, but for sure, I'm sure we left some stuff out. And if we left out something that you think is really important that we didn't touch on at least a little bit.
Oh my God, if you live in the South... Or, like, have your mom, like, ever tell you stories about, like, being in school or anything like that. Like, I want to hear about it. Like, that wasn't my life.
Your
like,
experience?
I want to hear about that.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, honestly, at this point, any emails. Send us emails.
Guys,
we just like getting them,
We need to hear them. We need things to talk about in many episodes. Just, like, entertain us. Just do the thing.
Please, please. So if you want to do that, email us at neighborhoodfeminist@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Instagram and DM us at Angry Neighborhood Feminist. You can get us on Facebook in the Facebook group or our business page. You can message us there or on Twitter at YANF Podcast.
YANF Podcast.
And I don't know. Rate and review. Subscribe. Please.
We haven't gotten any new reviews in a while. It would be really great to get some more activity there. It's just incredibly helpful to help us out there. I also just want to remind you guys to download the Radio Public app and to listen to us there and to tell your friends about us, to tell your friends to download the Radio Public app and to listen to us there. We really, really appreciate the listeners that we do have and the amazing and strong relationships that we've built with so many of you. It truly does make our days when we hear from you.
Totally.
And know that we also have people to rely on that are very like-minded. So I guess with that being said, we just encourage you
to rage on.
Bye.